Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton of the International Culinary Center, formerly the French Culinary Institute in New York City. But today, we're not in New York City. We're not at Roberta's in gray, cold New York. We're in beautiful Charleston at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. And I'm going to be broadcasting from here. And I'm so excited because we have, I think, one of the most knowledgeable, really proponents, journalists, historians of Southern food with us today. And I think he's so important. He's on the show and he's not a chef. And this is the first show we're ever doing where our guest is not a chef. John T. Edge is respected by all of the chefs from all over the country. He's the go-to guy when you want to know something. He has many, many publications, everything from Southern Belly, the ultimate food lover's companion to the South, to Truck Food Cookbook, which came out last year by Workman. He's been feted by the James Beard Foundation a few times, and in 2012 he won the ultimate award of the MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. He's in the who's who of food and beverage, and his books have been nominated for James Beard Awards. John, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much.
Well, I have to say that I'm just incredibly impressed. I was very excited to talk to you today because no one has ever answered this question for me. What is your personal philosophy or important to you? And I knew we were going to have fun today when you said, I'm a fan of daytime drinking, especially as I grow older. Start at lunch, home by 9. Okay. I have to say it's only 9:30 in the morning, so we're foregoing the Bloody Marys.
I was offered one when I walked in the door a few moments ago.
Did you take it?
No, I did not.
Oh. All right, so let's get to your roots and find out what you're drinking in the day.
Southerners drink. We have lots to forget.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably good therapy because you're all smiling. So you're born in Georgia.
Yes.
Right.
Small town. 50 people.
50 people.
Maybe.
First food memory.
My mother cooking vegetable soup. And she always, I didn't know what the heck a black peppercorn was. I was scared of them. They would always bob to the top. She always used marrow bones, and she would haggle with the butcher over whether he would get her marrow bones like she wanted for the vegetable soup. But vegetable soup, corn sticks, not cornbread like in a skillet, but the little
Cast iron
that have an imprint of an ear.
Right.
I love the texture of those.
Oh.
So that's my first food memory, is my mother cooking cornbread, my mother cooking vegetable soup.
What generation Southerner are you?
What does that mean? I don't know.
How many grandparents? I'm from New York City. Everybody's grandparent was born in another country.
Yeah. No, I'm three deep in the South. I was born to my parents late. My mother was 41 when I was born. My father was 38.
Uh-huh.
So my wife and I were joking. She's of similar age. Her parents are of similar age. Her mother just turned 90. So, you know, you start talking about your grandfather, you're talking about another century.
That's right. So did they all grow up in that town?
No. My family is from South Carolina, actually. My mother grew up about an hour from here in a little town called Bowman. And her father ran a narrow gauge railroad, the B&B, from Bowman to Branchville. and at one point ran a distillery and did a variety of other things. So my mother's family is especially rooted here, and our family has continually moved west. As we talked about, I grew up in Georgia and now live in Mississippi. I don't think I'm
going to
go much further. It feels west to me.
Really? How so?
When you think about the size of the South, you know, the American South is about the same landmass as Western Europe. You know, it's a big region.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea.
So the distance from where I grew up to where I live now is 7 hours. And that, you know, it's just Georgia to Mississippi.
Okay, so how does the culture change between those two?
Well, you know, where I live now, the hills of Mississippi, it's called Hill Country. You know, people may know Mississippi Delta as an iconic place. That's an hour west of me, and it's flatlands. You know, a dirt clod will cast a shadow on a bright day. It's so flat.
It's the Long Island of the South.
But where I live now are rolling hills. You know, you drive an hour north from me now, and you're on the tail end of Appalachia. You start to get into
More cultures
of a Piedmont.
And it takes it from the land.
Huh? Yes, it's very much. This is where I live now is subsistence-based farmers. An hour to the west in the Delta was plantation-based farming. But where I grew up is kind of the Piedmont of Georgia, kind of not dissimilar to where I am now. Right outside of Macon, Georgia, which is the center of the state. It was a great ferment for music culture. You know, that's where the Allman Brothers made their way. It's Otis Redding territory. It's Little Richard territory. Little Richard got his start working at the Pig and Whistle, a barbecue joint.
Really?
Singing in the parking lot, singing while he was dishing.
Tell me, rather going down, just talking about the food, historically, you know, before we had California and before we had, you know, air travel and the interstate system, how much did the South feed the United States? The United States might have been 30 states.
Sure.
In revolutionary times, even when it was that big.
Yeah, I mean, the distribution outside of the South, we were not a good exporter of much other than cotton. In the early days of the Republic, you know, certainly indigo and rice were exports from this part of the country. Mm-hmm. Where I live now, it was cotton that you exported. You know, the change has come that in more recent years, the South has moved from being a colonial economy to making its own things, not just shipping out. You know, I live in a poor place. Mississippi's a darn poor place. You see it in national statistics on obesity. You see it in education statistics and the like. But out of that adversity and out of that poverty has come this poverty-engendered creativity. And I think that's what distinguishes the place I live now.
Wow. So when you're – let's talk about – poverty and food, and does poverty mean there is no food, or does poverty mean impoverished food that they eat?
I've been reading this great book, Tracy McMillan's book. Do you know it? The American Way of Eating.
No, I don't.
She did a great job. She worked undercover at, you know, in farm fields in California, in a Walmart in.
Did she write Nickel and Dime?
No, it's Barbara Ehrenreich.
Okay, sorry.
But it is of the same ilk. But she makes a pretty convincing argument that, you know, working class people, even the working poor, want to cook great food. This notion that people don't care about food at some lower strata is not, it's not accurate. It's not my experience. You know, you talk to...
You're not born with different palates.
You're not born with different palates. So I don't think there is food of poverty in the South. I think one of the great things that is interesting about the South is because the whole region was poor for so long, we eat much the same things. You may find Frank Stitt doing a riff on cornbread or a riff on collard greens. But, you know, you see the connection quite readily between those two cuisines, between working class and white tablecloth cuisine. You know, we're not that far out of poverty in the South.
No, well, what I meant is, I think Tom Colicchio has come out with a documentary on hunger.
Right.
Hunger.
Yep.
So when you have poor people, you know, in the South, my question is on their diet, is it that they are raising their own food and eating just subsistence diets? Or are they caught up in the modern technology of eating fast food? That's, to me, impoverished food
right.
of nutrients.
The whole region is eating fast food.
It is fast food.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, a lot of the fast food chains came out of the South, whether it was Burger King or Hardee's. You know, those are Southern creations. Now Chick-fil-A, you know, those are Southern creations.
Why do you was it the poverty that generated them, or was it that you had the chicken farms down here? Or
there are a bunch of different ways to think about that. You know, in the same way a generation of housewives, you know, home cooks, women said, we don't want to bake our own bread. We love that white bread stuff in the wrapper because that frees us from the labor, you know.
Right.
They both, women both embraced that and were sold that. Southerners in the same way. You don't have to go churn your own buttermilk. We're selling you this carton right here. Look at it gleaming, you know, in the case.
Right.
We bought it.
Right.
We bought it. Now, you know, whether, you know, and a whole generation of people too said, I don't want my child to have the same, you know, life I had. I grew up a sharecropper. I don't want my son to have that tough of a life. Don't farm.
Right.
You know, get the hell off the farm.
Right.
So those are powerful pulls
and
pushes.
How does that extend to people wanting to be cooks and chefs?
I mean, there is a stigma in the South, especially among African Americans, and less so among working class white.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a cook is what you did if you were black because you had no other option.
Right.
So now, as you know, as we see a skyrocketing interest in cookery, and you see, you know, middle class white trust fund kids going into, you know, they want to be a chef. You know, you hear that drive to be a chef a lot less among young African American kids because there's still a stigma attached to it.
You know, we've noticed that at the school, that we have very, you know, we don't have the proportion that we should have of African-Americans. And Jacques Pepin is one of the biggest proponents because he actually worked for 10 years at Howard Johnson's in the test kitchen. And everyone, all the cooks he worked with were African-American. And he said they were some of the best cooks, most talented cooks he came across.
But at that point, they didn't have a damn choice.
Yeah, and they didn't get paid.
There was no trajectory.
The pay level has changed.
Pay level still sucks.
It does on the very entry level, and if you stay in there. But the trust fund kids, their parents are letting them now enter the field because they're expanding. They're not just having the restaurant; they're going into media. Even if they have a restaurant, they're a restaurant owner.
Right.
Where Nobu, believe me, is not making minimum wage. You know, when you have restaurant owner, it's more like small business owners.
Right.
So that's a whole different we can get into. But I think this, there to me in the South, it's one of the places where great food in America is born, teaches the rest of us. Last night I ate at Husk and I had the sheep's head fish, and I never saw a sheep's head fish. I asked the waiter, he says, it's sort of seasonal, December to May, it's kind of a snapper. And he said to me, look it up on your, you know, smartphone when I go put the order in. And I put it on, I'm from Brooklyn, you know, and what kept popping up was Sheep's Head Bay in Brooklyn, which is, you know, I went to Lundy's, it was our own little fishing fleet. And so I looked at the fish. It is ugly. It is ugly.
It is an
and
ugly
it's
fish.
Big, but it's delicious. I will tell you that. And then I thought, I was sitting there and I just popped in by myself to have dinner. So I thought, well, let me read about in Wikipedia what Sheep's Head Bay is about in Brooklyn, because I never did. I literally grew up in the next parish. People understand that word here. And at the end of it, and it said, oh, Sheep's Head Bay was named after this ancient fish, the sheep's head. And I couldn't believe it, which is rarely found in our waters anymore.
Right.
And I thought, my gosh, you know, you come to the South and you find the real thing. Even my neighborhood fish, who's extinct. So, how did the South educate the American palate? How has it transcended the American palate?
Well, I mean, the imprint I don't know if we've educated. I think we serve a role in American cuisine now, is that people come south looking for some past preserved in amber. They come south looking for an American past in the southern present. There was this writer for Harper's in the 1890s who, he was writing about people in the mountain south, but he described them, and I would argue it would have applied and still might apply to southerners too, as our nation's contemporary ancestors. Now, I would argue that for all those people who come to the south looking for the past, it's not really here, you know. And
what do you mean it's not here?
Well, you know, take where I live, Oxford, Mississippi. You know, the Mississippi Delta, probably the most resonant place in Mississippi. People come to the Mississippi Delta. They come searching for blues music. They come searching for the vestiges of plantation architecture and plantation agriculture, too. And they're looking for the past, and they think that the South is so deeply rooted in the past. And you say, well, actually, where you are really wasn't settled till post-Civil War, you know, just before Civil War, and really, you know, the plantation agriculture is Civil War era. Not, you know, the person from New England comes, you know, and their trajectory, you know, their life of their place goes back to the 1600s, and here we are, you know, we're not that old. On some levels, I think what we have in the South is this, you know, because of the Civil War and because of the Civil Rights Movement, you know, the two great battles of our region's history, those moments are so totemic. So when somebody thinks about the South, they think about the Civil War, they think about the Civil Rights Movement on some level.
Yes.
I want them to think more about the Civil Rights Movement because that, to me, is the defining struggle.
Oh, well, wait a minute. Let's hold it right there.
Okay.
We're going to take a break.
Yeah.
And we'll come back, and this is fascinating.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. Full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton talking to John T. Edge. And we're broadcasting today from the Planters Inn in Charleston, South Carolina, during the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. John, you're just getting into a fascinating subject, which I don't think I was rambling. We're both rambling, but I hope everybody's enjoying our ramble here. You started talking about the Civil Rights Movement as mm-hmm. being a defining and influential factor. How does that work in with the food field and with the history?
Sure. Well, there are a number of ways I think the Civil Rights Movement is resonant today in the world of food. One, 2014 will be the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, mm-hmm. which desegregated places of public accommodation, including restaurants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't often think about the Civil Rights Movement in terms of food, but that struggle to desegregate restaurants, and in particular lunch counters, beginning in Greensboro, North Carolina, reaching great probably the most horrific example of that was in Jackson, Mississippi in 1963. But those were about desegregating restaurants. And the reason restaurants matter is because the intimacy of eating is resonant within the people who fought over that. Those lunch counters were, you know, those are almost like confessional spaces. You know, you are a supplicant kneeling at the altar and you're sitting side by side with someone. Mm. And to engage in the most intimate act we engage in every day, except for that other act, sex, you know, that public intimacy riled the hell out of intransigent whites.
How was that period of integration? How long did it really take?
How long did it take?
Because I can't imagine the next day they all went out and said, okay.
No, well, you know.
And how did the owners of the restaurant?
Well, there were some. Like, there was a guy in North Carolina, in New Bern, North Carolina, Moore's Barbecue. He, instead of integrating a restaurant, he cranked up a bulldozer, knocked his restaurant down. See, I'm not integrating this. You know, you can't have my building. The federal government was attempting to say, you know, you have two separate dining rooms. Here's how you're going to use them. And he's like, nobody's going to tell me what to do with my dining room. Mm. You know, there are tales like that that are mm-hmm. that are kind of, I don't know, just show how ridiculous it all was. Mm. You know, there are other tales, too, of people. There was a woman in Montgomery, Alabama, a woman named Georgia Gilmore, who was a cook. In a white restaurant, and she refused, in the era of Rosa Parks, she refused to get off the bus, a similar kind of exchange. She was called to testify during the Montgomery bus boycott and the attempt in 54 to declare that an illegal protest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she told about how she's treated on the bus. She loses her job as a cook in a white restaurant. And King and some of his lieutenants set her up in her own business, in her house, kind of a backdoor restaurant. Mm. And she built an integrated restaurant there under cloak. You know, King and Kennedy ate there. You know, everybody came to this woman's backdoor restaurant, and they sat at her oak trestle table in a middle-class black neighborhood of Montgomery, Alabama. So even though there are lots of tales of people like Mr. Moore bulldozing his restaurant during that moment, mm-hmm. that intimacy that is engendered at the table mm-hmm. Was important. And there were Southerners working toward the good, toward positive social change, people like Georgia Gilmore, mm-hmm. curating this kind of beloved community at her table.
Mm. How long did it really take for integrated restaurants to be comfortable?
You know, we've resegregated now, but I'll answer your question. But, you know, we've resegregated by class in the South. But how long did it take? You know, so that was 64. The act was signed in July. You know, and the federal government sent out people to test it. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of dissension. What a lot of restaurants did in the immediate aftermath is they formed something called key clubs. Mm. Have you ever heard of this?
No. Oh, well, probably private.
Yeah, they were private clubs. And, you know, you didn't really have to have a key. What you had to have was a white face mm-hmm. For admission. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they chose, there were nominal fees. You'd pay like $1 a year. Mm-hmm. But a lot of restaurants became key clubs.
I see.
And some of those lasted up into the 80s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did a piece a long time back about a guy. He had a place called the Shady Nook Key Club. And he went going through the 80s. He was a Miss America freak. He was an interesting guy.
Yeah, I could say. So tell me, when did the we're going to talk about the new Southern chef. And if you could put that in context for us. You
know, the new Southern chef?
The new Southern chef. Because I don't know if the listeners or myself know that much about the old Southern chefs. I mean,
sure.
We know about Southern food.
Sure.
But the rise of restaurants in the South and how restaurant cooking, it seems like a lot of the young chefs like Sean Brock, they're embracing home cooking. They're embracing mm-hmm. that. So where is the role of the chef in the South? Where did it start and how did it evolve?
Sure.
And then we'll get into what's happening now.
Sure. I mean, the kind of modern Southern chef, I think, has roots in two restaurants. One, Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Bill Neal opened that in 1982. The same year, Frank Stitt opened Highlands Bar and Grill in 1982. Those two chefs and those two restaurants really are, for me, and for I think for most people who try to make sense of this, that's the beginning of the kind of new Southern vanguard, is those two restaurants. Both men decided to dig deep into their place. Bill Neal. For Bill, it was going to the University of North Carolina, digging into the stacks and doing primary research on Southern food culture. You know, in a day when a lot of us know that's the kind of work Sean Brock is doing here in Charleston, Bill Neal was doing that back in the 70s and 80s. Published a great book, Bill Neal's Southern Cooking. Rose to prominence when Craig Claiborne showed up with his IBM Selectric typewriter, plopped it down in Bill Neal's kitchen, and published Bill Neal's recipe for shrimp and grits. You know, that dish, which is now probably the most widely embraced and adopted and restaurant dish of the 20th century, Southern restaurant dish of the 20th century, that was a shrimper's dish. That was, you know, a working class. You pull shrimp in the morning, you throw some butter in a pan and a few creek shrimp and over some grits from the night before.
Hmm.
It was not what it has become now, which is kind of a foil for all manner of experimentation. That dish had its restaurant beginnings when Claiborne interviews Neal at about the time his restaurant's opening and about the time his book's coming out.
Hmm.
That restaurant became hugely influential. Everyone from Robert Stelling here at Hominy Grill in Charleston to John Currents in my hometown of Oxford, Mississippi, worked in that kitchen, came through that kitchen.
Well, let me ask you, what were the early restaurants like in the South? When were the, you know, not the the Wayfarers restaurant,
right?
But where fine dining came, and what were the chefs like back then? And so,
sure,
to understand Bill Neal and what he was changing, what was, you know,
sure,
back in the 1930s, 20s,
right,
what were the restaurants like, and what were they like in the 19th century?
The restaurants of the South in an earlier day, there weren't many restaurant towns. Like now, you think of Charleston as a great restaurant town. Charleston was you know, hotels served you well, and the same might be said in Nashville, where the Maxwell House Hotel. You know that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New Orleans was certainly a strong restaurant town, and vestiges of that are still alive and kicking, mm-hmm, from Antoine's to Galatoire's, both mm-hmm over 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
If you took things on a more working class or everyday level, there's a restaurant in Bessemer, Alabama, which is still going, called the Bright Star. And the Bright Star is a Greek-owned restaurant. Bessemer is just outside of Birmingham. And when people started pouring in there to work in the steel and iron industry, Greek immigrants set up a restaurant. And that restaurant evolved from a cubbyhole to a grand kind of palace. It said, I'm Greek, I've made it. You see vestiges of that. But on the whole, fine dining was not a big part of the calculus in the South,
mm-hmm,
until more recently. You know, this comes back to what we were talking about earlier. It was mm-hmm a poor place.
Mm-hmm.
The chefs, you know, one of the great cities in the South for restaurants has always been New Orleans. And one of the ways to think about your question is to read this book called Creole Feast. Do you know this book?
No, I don't.
It's by a guy named Rudy Lombard. And Rudy's of New Orleans, was a civil rights activist in New Orleans. It all comes back to race, too. But Rudy wrote this great book called Creole Feast. And it was a profile of the African-American chefs who worked the kitchens, worked the big hotel kitchens. And these guys were badasses. You know, these were the cooks who, you know, could turn out oysters Bienville for 500. These were people like Austin Leslie. Do you remember hearing of Austin? So Austin was, you know, that TV show in the 70s, Frank's Place.
Yeah.
It's one of the best TV shows ever produced. It was in essence a thinly disguised portrait of Austin Leslie, who's also in this book, Creole Feast.
Mm-hmm.
But though that generation of chefs, African-American chefs, who fed New Orleans but were never recognized, you know, they were the backbone. And hotel dining, you know, those guys ran it. They
was
did.
Paul Prudhomme the first celebrity chef out of New Orleans?
Arguably. Brett Anderson wrote a great profile of him that won a Beard Award a few years ago. And he was arguably the first celebrity chef in America, you know.
Yeah.
and taught us what it meant to be a celebrity chef. Remember, he was in New Orleans, and he opened a branch in San Francisco, and everybody went bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, he leveraged that moment in a way no one else had before.
Right. So getting back to who is the new chef in the South.
Sure.
Are these the trust fund kids? Are these the college-educated, taking it, not opening the Greek Palace, but saying, gee, I love the place I was born. We have some kick-ass great food,
right,
and I can bring it to a white tablecloth or a non-white tablecloth. But I can put out a food that's intelligent.
Sure.
Because I have to say there's a lot of similarities with the Southern chefs, with the Western chefs, and mm-hmm. the Northeastern chefs. They all love each other. Chefs love
sure.
each other. So who is the profile of the Southern
chefs? There's two kinds. Since we're in Charleston, let's talk about one chef here. Sean Brock is a great example of that new guard of chef. Mm-hmm. And Sean, you know, is a kid from the coal fields of Virginia, and grew up poor. Grew up with his grandmother's cooking and his mother's cooking, and grew up to value that. And when he came to culinary school, he went to culinary school here, then began experimenting, began playing with molecular cuisine in his first job and second job out. And then has kind of returned to the fold now, where he's digging deep in. He spent a long time digging deep in the low country, and is now talking about, here's where I grew up. I need to know Wise, Virginia, where I grew up. I need to know the Appalachian roots of my cookery. That's one kind of chef who wants to dig deep into their place, is doing research. It reminds me of what Bill Neal was doing in the 70s and 80s. That's the kind of chef Sean is, archival research-based chef interpreting the foods of a Southern past, very specific to a place. Mm. There's another kind of chef who I'm really fascinated with. A great example of that is a guy named Chris Shepherd. He has a restaurant called Underbelly in Houston. And Chris is not a native of Houston, but I think he grew up in Oklahoma. But like any kind of immigrant to a place, he sees it fresh and sees it new and falls in love with it. And he's interpreting, if Sean's interpreting Charleston in the 1700s or 1800s, Chris is interpreting Houston right now. And he's saying, this is the most crazily diverse city I've ever seen. 90 languages spoken in Houston. Houston is, by some measures, the most diverse city in America. Thank you very much, New York.
We have 137 languages.
That's
in our
all
schools.
Fine and good. That's all fine and good.
Sorry.
I didn't say that was the only measure.
Right.
Go look at the Forbes article.
All right. Okay.
But Houston is this dizzyingly diverse place. Mm. And so Chris is interpreting that diversity on his menu. So you walk in, and there are glossies of all the different places that inspired him on his wall, all these different places he did stages. He didn't go to Italy. He didn't go to France. Mm. He didn't go to New York. Mm. He went to the strip mall down the road from him in Houston and staged with the Thai family that runs this restaurant, the Korean family that runs that restaurant, the Mexican family that runs this restaurant. And his restaurant is an homage to all those people.
And so what's his menu like?
Like, one of my favorite dishes is, those rice sticks? Those long tubular rice sticks.
Yeah.
So he takes those, he slices them, and pan fries them, and he gets a little bit of crunch on them, and does a braised goat with that, and a little bit of guanzhong, the chili paste, mm-hmm. Hits it with a little lager.
Beer?
Uh-huh. And I think a sprinkle of sesame and chervil. And he's doing, in essence, a Korean dish with goat that he sourced from a farmer down the road. He loves that dish, loves that place. And that dish, he's arguing, is as Southern as what Sean's doing, serving Sea Island red peas that are, have a provenance dating back to the 1600s. And I buy what Chris is doing. Mm-hmm. He also does, fried chicken and biscuits. Mm-hmm. But he's saying, in this Southern moment, here's what the South looks like. The South looks as much like, a Korean strip mall restaurant It owes as much a debt to a Korean strip mall restaurant as it does to somebody's grandmother.
And you, as the celebrated food historian of the South, agree with him.
Yes. I don't want to preserve the South in amber. There's a whole hell of a lot of reasons the South should change. We were a bunch of son of a bitches for a long time. You know, we have a pretty horrific history. So if you believe in the future of the South, you don't want to arrest its development. You don't want to preserve it in amber. Mm-hmm. You embrace the progress and you see a South that's changing. Yes, I want people to know our history, but I don't want people to live our history.
Wow. Okay. We have to take a break. We're going to come back. And this is just fascinating. I wish there were 10 John Edges to come put our chefs and restaurants in perspective. You're listening to Chef Story. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center sitting with John T. Edge. And we're sitting at the Planters Inn in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. And John T. Edge, aside from being an incredible food writer, someone said it's like calling John T. Edge, a food writer, is like saying Herman Melville wrote booklets on fishing. But actually, his day job and one of the most outstanding contributions he is making to our country is that he's the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, based in Oxford, Mississippi.
At the University of Mississippi,
At the University of Mississippi. And I would kill for an invitation to your annual symposium. It's one of the hottest, hardest tickets to get as a food professional. But tell me, how did the Southern Foodways Alliance come about? What's its mission?
Sure. The SFA is 13 years old now. There were a couple of attempts in the 90s to start something similar. Edna Lewis and Scott Peacock started something called the Society for the Preservation and Revitalization of Southern Food. And then there was another effort called the American Southern Food Institute, all with similar ideas, but they never got nonprofit status. They didn't have the logistical piece of it kind of figured out. When I was a grad student, I went back to school after a corporate career, in a fitful corporate career. Went back to school because kind of what we've been talking about. I love my region, but I'm also angry with my region because of things we've done over time. And I wanted to resolve that in my head. You know, you love your place, you're pissed off at your place. Like, mm-hmm. How do you balance? Mm-hmm. So I went back to school to get a master's degree and realized when I was there that I met all these people studying the South, thinking about the South from all these different perspectives. I met someone studying the front porch as public space in the South, and how one occupies that space and how you relate to others from your porch. Obscure, bizarre, kind of, you know. And I met lots of people studying the civil rights movement. That's what, you know, I came to do. But you can get a master's at the University of Mississippi in Southern Studies. And at the point I showed up, there wasn't anybody thinking about food. Now a third of our graduate students come in wanting to do food studies research.
Ooh, what's that about?
Well, we just hired a postdoctoral fellow who's teaching foodways classes. She did her PhD work on the civil rights movement and food. So you can take classes from her. We also have a strong internship program with the Southern Foodways Alliance. Where graduate students work with them too, with us too. We are also about to hire a full-time tenure-track professor who will teach foodways classes as well. So all this is culturally based, though. It's not, it is not a food studies program, but is a program that studies the South and offers a way to think about and study the South through food. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So what's your vision for the Food Alliance?
We have spent the last decade plus documenting Southern food culture. That's primarily what we do. We have one full-time oral historian and about four contract oral historians who go out and interview row crop farmers and oystermen and gumbo cooks and fried chicken cooks. No chefs. All working class artisans, farmers, cooks. With the idea that we're kind of paying down a debt of pleasure that we owe to those generations of cooks. And we're preserving their stories for posterity in a modern-day version of the WPA effort that sent people out across America in the 1930s to document American culture. We're just focusing a little tighter. We're focusing on the South, and we're telling the story of all those cooks. You know, chefs buy into what we do, I think, because, you know, if you take that old saw that journalism is the first draft of history, then I think a lot of what we're doing with the SFA and interviewing these cooks and farmers and artisans is the first draft of a lot of menus. You know,
absolutely.
We do this research, we tell these stories, and make films as well. We've collected about 850 oral histories, all digitized. We were lucky to start at a time when digitization was easy. Made about 37 films and have a fairly robust program going forward. But we're going to grow the heck out of that. And so the oral history and film components of what we do will grow. And so will the educational piece. So there are more and more students coming to the University of Mississippi to get a master's degree in Southern Studies, which is, you know, if somebody knows an American Studies degree, think about an American Studies degree focused on the South. That's it.
And when you do American Studies, you have to pick a major. It isn't like you're a generalist.
Well, no, American Studies, at least Southern Studies, as we interpret it, is interdisciplinary. So when I went through the program, I took, I took classes in political science. I took classes in art history. Mm-hmm. I took classes certainly in history. But you become a broad thinker. Mm-hmm. You learn to read your region, and that's mm-hmm. what excited me about the program and what I'm most excited now is there's a whole generation of students showing up.
So the Southern Food Alliance is a nonprofit organization.
Part of the University of Mississippi.
So it's a division. It's in the Department of Southern Food Studies.
I work at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, which has been around for 30 plus years. Mm-hmm. The Southern Foodways Alliance is an institute of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture.
I see. Okay. So
at the University of Mississippi.
Totally operated by the University of Mississippi.
Well, yes
but
and no.
Your governance is.
We've got a board outside of that. Uh-huh. So we have a board of directors, the Southern Foodways Alliance does. We are University of Mississippi employees, but, you know, like many nonprofits, university is our incubator. University gives us office space. University gives us one budget line, but we raise the rest. So
your mission is to
document,
capture,
study, and celebrate the diverse food cultures of the American South.
Okay.
Diverse food cultures of the changing American South.
So you have to know where you came from, but you also want to know what's going on today.
Yeah, I'm as interested in, I'll tell you an example. I grew up drinking sweet tea, love sweet tea. You know, mm-hmm. you're a kid, you're eight, like, you know, you crave sugar. Mm-hmm. My son, who's about to turn 12, if you ask him what his favorite drink is, it's not sweet tea. What do you think it is?
Oh, I hope not soda.
Or chata.
What's that?
Horchata, the rice water drink of Mexico.
Oh.
You know horchata.
Oh, I do now.
Yeah. You know, it's rice water, some cinnamon.
How did he get introduced to that?
Because in this Southern moment, the best place he can go get barbecue is a Mexican taco shop, like an honest Mexican taco shop, where he's getting tacos al pastor and horchata. And I guess what I'm saying is, I'm as interested in that, as I am in the barbecue joint, Helen Turner's barbecue joint in Brownsville, Tennessee, right. That's an hour and a half from me. They're both important.
I see where you're talking about the preserved in amber. Now I'm getting it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if it was preserved in amber, it would be dying. And the fact that you have all these new influences and they're being really deliciously integrated.
Right.
It's very dynamic for the South.
It's dynamic and it's just honest. It's what you could choose to look at the South, and I think a lot of people do, is this place where the past exists in the present. But if you look with open eyes and see what the South really is.
What's a new crop in the South? I mean, we think rice, we think okra, we think peanuts.
Sure.
Is there, you know, with all of this immigration here, because I don't think the diversity is just in Houston. I think it's really all over the country, but I think a lot of people come to the South because you have great climate, it's beautiful weather down here. So there must be new entrants in the products.
You know, I don't know if this is going to go over big, but I was talking to Sean Brock about this yesterday. He'd just gotten back from a trip to Africa, and he was talking about this really hyper-bitter eggplant. And he starts describing it to me, and I said, oh, yeah, I had that in Atlanta 2 weeks ago. Two months ago. And it's there's a group in Atlanta called Global Growers, and what they do is work with newly arrived African refugees. And they set them up – well, they don't set them up. These women do it themselves. But they're building their own CSA for Africans by Africans. And their, you know, prized ingredient is Simtok, which is this bitter eggplant that Sean had. And I had it in Atlanta, you know, months before.
What's your dream for the South?
That we fix our broken bucket, you know, that we invest in. Well, how would I put this? My dream for the South is that we acknowledge our ugly past and work towards a beautiful future.
Wow. On that note, I want to thank you. This has been fascinating.
My pleasure. It's great
fun.
I
hope if you're up in New York, we can have a meal. I'll take you to Sheepshead Bay.
Deal.
All right. Okay.
Deal.
Thank you, John T. Edge, of the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. And you've been listening to Chef's Story, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.